Okay, it's time for Tech Talk with the Boston Globe's Hiawatha Bray, and he's bringing us some pretty incredible research out of MIT on Parkinson's disease. Hiawatha is technology writer for the Globe. Hiawatha, welcome back.
I'm glad to be back.
So, listen, Parkinson's, fastest growing neurological disorder in the world right now, second only to Alzheimer's. Give us just the headlines on this technology.
Well, it's kind of incredible. A team of engineers, these aren't doctors, although they worked with doctors, but a team of engineers at MIT and working with people at the Mayo Clinic and Boston University and a bunch of other places have figured out a way to try to detect Parkinson's at its earliest stages by basically using radar to keep track of your breathing. I mean, the minute you say that, it sounds so nutty you can hardly believe it. But they have figured out a way to use a sensor in somebody's bedroom that basically uses a form of radar to measure the chest movements of the person while he or she is sleeping. And from that, they can use software to take all of the data that's coming back to the radar and just isolate the person's breathing and nothing else. And then on top of that, they came up with a way of programming an artificial intelligence program that can look at the breathing patterns of a person and spot early signs of not Alzheimer's, although they are going to try it on Alzheimer's too, but they are currently trying it on Parkinson's disease.
Okay.
And they say it's accurate to within about 89% of the time, it accurately identifies somebody as having early stage Parkinson's disease, just from a radar image of them breathing. It's the weirdest thing I've ever heard of.
And kind of cool, I'm not going to lie.
It's insanely cool.
Yeah, super cool. So I want to dive into this. That was the headline I was looking for.
Right.
So Parkinson's is a tough disease. Just to remind folks, there have been many beloved Americans who have had it, and we've watched them have that disease progress. For example, Michael J. Fox. Mm-hmm. Here he is during a 2021 interview on CBS, and he's recalling the moment the doctors told him he had the disease more than 30 years ago.
We didn't know what to expect. We didn't know what would happen. We didn't know. No one could say when I would have more effects, more symptoms than what I had, which was a twitching pinky.
So, you know, it's saying there, at that time, I had a twitching pinky, and we didn't know how this was going to unfold. As it turns out, part of the reason this is a big deal, this discovery, Hiawatha, is because it's very hard to detect Parkinson's disease until the disease has progressed pretty far. Is that right?
Absolutely. That's one of the things. I mean, I'm not an expert on Parkinson's disease, and I'm learning a lot, and it's really kind of horrifying because you can't take a blood test or any other kind of a test or a biopsy or something and say, yes, you are at the early stages of Parkinson's disease. The problem is that the early stages is where the damage is done. And by the time the symptoms that scientists and doctors can recognize are visible, things like the twitching and having trouble balancing on one's feet, by the time it's recognized, the damage is done. They can't do anything. So if they could figure out some way to identify the Parkinson's symptoms very early, then at least they could begin to start developing drugs that would arrest the progress of the disease. And that's what this is all about. And people have been tearing their hair trying to figure out how to do that. And what they did at MIT, Dina Katabi and a bunch of engineers at MIT, look back at 1817 when this English guy first identified the disease.
The disease was named after him, correct?
That's right, Parkinson, the guy who first identified it. And he just in passing said, it looks like the people who have this disease, their breathing changes. Something's different about the way they breathe from other people. And back then, there wasn't any way they could really measure that in any consistent way. So they started thinking, is there some possibility that we can do this? We can measure how somebody's health is progressing just by the rhythm of their breath. And they think they figured out a way to do that. And of course, they hope to continue doing this for other diseases like Alzheimer's and potentially other neurological diseases. And one of the coolest things about it is when you do all kinds of sleep studies, usually you have to attach something to the person's body. It often makes it difficult for them to sleep. It's uncomfortable. With this, it's like radar. How they do this, I just have no idea. But they can beam radio waves in your bedroom, and just reading the reflections, they can take all the other data, throw it out, and just pick out, that's him breathing.
Okay, so as I was reading about this, I was thinking, you know, okay, so in my bedroom, we have my husband and me and two dogs, one of whom snores a lot, right? So how are they distinguishing? Is this like in an isolated environment where somebody's in a special sleep room and they, or is this thing literally meant to be set up one day that it's just in your bedroom?
Well, it's not intended to be used all the time, at least not in its current form. And presumably, this would be used just for one person, because it would just really complicate things to have more than one person breathing. But the thing is, and I left this out, they are able to get one day's worth of data. Mm. and do the diagnosis. They do not have to have it running all the time. Probably what you would end up with is a situation where they'd run it maybe once a month or something to see if there's any change. And that's very important. One of the things they really hope to be able to do with this is to track progress of the disease, or when using, like if they come up with a drug that might help to arrest its progress, they could use this to see if changes in breathing indicate that the drug is working. So they're already using this in various clinical tests, but they are not yet, as I'm pretty sure they're not yet using it to test as a way of developing new Parkinson's drugs. But ultimately, that's what they hope to do. Somebody comes up with a new Parkinson's drug and they start doing regular breathing tests to see if it's working better. But and up to now, there hasn't been any way of doing a test in the short term that gives you any idea as to whether or not you're getting better or worse.
Okay, two curiosity questions, and you may or may not know the answers to these. The first is, so, I mean, if you don't know what you don't know, then is the idea that everybody might at one point need to have this pinged on them once a month, or are there genetic predispositions towards Parkinson's? And because, as you said before, you can't diagnose it early. So how do you know who needs to have their breath measured? Do you understand what I'm asking?
I have no idea, but you just asked an absolutely fantastic question, because in theory, you could actually make this available to anybody, because in theory, you could like even have a doctor rent this or lend it to you. You run it in your house for one night to test you, and theoretically, you could have a world in which everybody gets this test, because it would not be very expensive to run. That's another obvious consequence of this. This would be relatively cheap to do.
Yeah, and home-based. All right, mm-hmm. So the other question that came up, and again, you may or may not know the answer, they went back to a passing reference from Parkinson in the early 1800s.
Yeah.
Was this a case where somebody sat down and said, I am looking for a new technology to test for Parkinson's disease, or somebody said, I have figured out how to measure breathing with a radar. Where could that be useful? Do we know?
I don't know which came first, but I can definitely tell you that this kind of biometric data, people are doing this in all directions all over the place. There are countless technologies being developed to measure how you breathe, how you walk, the movement of your eyes, cameras that look at your eyes to measure whether or not, I mean, I don't know if anybody's using that for Parkinson's, but conceivably that could even work. Doctors are constantly finding out that there's all kinds of biometric markers that until recently you couldn't use. Mm-hmm. But now with computers and sensors and cameras everywhere and all of them dirt cheap, you can try that. You can put a smartphone in your pocket and they can tell by the way you walk whether or not you're on the verge of having a stroke. Things like that. It's amazing because of the way you walk. It changes when you have certain ailments. And that's becoming more and more common. And this is just another version of it, but an even more impressive one.
So understanding the pain, I lost my mom to a form of dementia, and it was so painful. And I'm sure that there are listeners with loved ones who have Parkinson's, with loved ones who have Alzheimer's, who, of course, are saying, wait a minute, are you telling me that there's some level of hope here or something new? So what do we know about next steps? What comes next?
Well, I think at this point, they're just trying to use this in tests to help doctors do a better job of identifying it. But whether or not something is going to come of this in the near future, I honestly have to say I don't know. And even if it does, this is not a cure. This is not a treatment. It is just a way of identifying the problem, hopefully before it's gotten to the point where it's really bad.
All right. Fascinating stuff. I want to shift gears, and that was not actually a pun intended, but I'll lean into it because there's some other writing that you've been doing that I think is really interesting. We have talked about electric vehicles here on the show before. You know, Massachusetts has a goal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 33% compared to 1990 levels by 2025. Further by 2030, EVs are a big part of that. You've raised this new wrinkle. So tell us about that.
Well, it's not really a new wrinkle, but it's kind of an obvious issue that people are only just starting to think about. Who's going to fix these cars?
Yeah.
Hardly anybody knows how to fix electric cars. There's this organization, ASC. If you go get your car fixed, the guys will say, we're ASC certified mechanics. They have about 292,000 ASC certified mechanics in the United States. Only about 3,100 of them know how to fix electric cars.
3,100,
whole country. That's just one. There are other, you know, they're not the only people who know how to fix electric cars. But the point is, there's only a few thousand 100,000 people in America and also all over the world. Don't get me wrong, this is not a crisis, this is a problem, and people are suddenly scrambling to fix it. I mean, there are bunches of people who have to get this right. Rental car companies have to get it right. The car dealerships have to get it right. Nissan, they're about to start selling this new electric car, and they suddenly realized they're going to have to train everybody in every Nissan dealership how to fix these cars. And they've launched this crash program. And of course, all the other automakers are doing similar things because their own dealerships have to have people who can fix them. Boston is getting ready to electrify all of its school buses. They're going to need people to fix those things. That's 750 school buses. Who's going to fix them? And then last in line are all the independent, you know, the Midases and the Monroes, the corner garages. They're the last ones to worry about because right now there aren't that many old electric cars that are being fixed in those places. But sooner or later, they're going to have people. So I wrote about this guy, wonderful guy named Craig Van Battenberg. He's out in Worcester and he's running a school. And he actually teaches courses all over the world on how to fix a light. He just got back from, I think he was in Cincinnati. He's trained people in Denmark. He's trained people in the UK. And he's just got more business than he knows what to do with. He only just started teaching people how to fix Teslas. And now we're seeing all over the country, oh, by the way, our, what is it, Madison Tech?
Madison Park.
Madison Park.
Right.
They have just gotten ready
to
launch.
Technical High School.
Technical High School. They have just launched a training program for electric cars. But other community colleges through the area, they're not necessarily ready yet. Everybody's finally starting to gear up for this, and I think it's just fascinating and cool. But the funny part of it is, in the long run, you're just not going to need anywhere near as many people to fix electric cars as you need to fix internal combustion, or they call them ICE cars for some reason.
Internal combustion engine, yeah, internal, ICE.
Exactly. So people call them ICE cars. They are just far more complex. There are far more things to go wrong. And most of this stuff, electric cars don't even have them. You don't have to change the oil. You don't have to worry about rebuilding the transmission. You don't have to put a new cylinder head in them. None of that stuff. Electric motors are incredibly simple. And even the brakes don't wear out as fast because the electric motor helps slow down the car. Hmm. On the other hand, an electric car battery will kill you. It absolutely will if you don't handle it properly. It contains an immense amount of power, easily could electrocute you. And of course, did you see the story about the car that had been in the junkyard? I think it was a Tesla, been sitting in the junkyard for 3 weeks. All of a sudden, it just started to burn.
Oh my goodness.
It just started
okay.
to burn because those batteries are crazy. And it just started to burn. 3 weeks sitting in a junkyard. It was amazing.
Tesla's not going to love you for that story on air, but fascinating stuff. As always, I love having you here. We've been speaking with Hiawatha Bray, who's the technology writer for the Boston Globe, author of the novel Power in the Blood, and our tech talk expert. Hiawatha, thanks.
You're welcome.
Great to have you.